You might have heard it said that there are no atheists in foxholes. It is an incredibly simplistic and somewhat insulting way of speaking to the experience of coming face to face with our profound and unavoidable vulnerability and mortality. As a minister, I am privileged to bear witness to and walk with people in these sorts of moments, at the bedside in someone's final hours, across a chair from a couple facing the likely end of their marriage, hearing the first ever out loud utterance of terrible things impossibly survived, or holding space in those first few hours after a sudden loss. All of these tender moments of life are so beautiful and holy and heartbreaking. Something does happen to us in these moments. I've seen it, felt it. Something happens, though nothing like what I would call deathbed conversion. These vulnerable moments are less transformative than they are revelatory, though transformation is a common byproduct, just later. In these actual moments, in the slow-moving words, in the awkward small talk, the free-flowing tears, the unveiled face, there is an undeniable experience of grace. By which I mean an experience of the ways we are all, underneath everything, connected. We spend a lot of time not tending to this reality, a lot of time asserting our independence and experiencing our isolation. But in these most vulnerable moments of life and death, loss and change, we can do nothing other than feel the way that we are just so human. As Unitarian Universalist minister David Bombaugh says it, beneath all our differences, behind all our diversity, there is a unity that makes us one and binds us together forever, in spite of time and death and the space between the stars. This, Bombaugh says, is the proposition to which we Unitarian Universalists dedicate our lives, and its practice is the reason Unitarian Universalist congregations exist. As I was thinking about a central metaphor for today's service, I remembered the prominent Universalist P.T. Barnum. Now, you probably know Barnum as the founder of America's Big Top Three-Ring Circus, but you're probably less familiar with his passionate Universalist faith. Barnum's 1890 pamphlet, Why I Am a Universalist, was the first of its kind to circulate across the globe, affirming the Universalist good news that every single person would be ultimately saved by God's love. Translating Barnum's language for today, as Universalists, we believe that none of us are beyond the reach of love. There is nothing you can do that would make you unworthy of love and its power for transformation. And so we might imagine Barnum's faith and Barnum's profession merging, and envision our faith statement as one that asserts that every single one of us is a part of the greatest show on earth. The great show of life held together in one great big top. We can take turns as spectators and performers. Furthermore, we can imagine our congregations as the local manifestation of all this big top, where we practice making space for all of life's diversity. Or to say it the way Universalist Gordon Bucky McKeeman put it, Universalists believe that all of us are going to end up together, so we might as well learn how to get along with each other now. The night after my first interview with the search committee, I had one of those rare dreams that was both vivid enough to remember and also translatable without much consultation of an online dream decoder. Not that I consult online dream decoders much. Anyway, in the dream, I was coming for my second interview with the committee, which was in real life to be 2 days later. In my dream, the committee greeted me and told me that they had assembled, they decided that rather than a second interview, they had assembled a dinner party. And for the dinner party, they had invited one or two representatives from every sub-community of Northern Colorado. I looked around the room. There were gun fanatics. There were tenured professors, also eager CSU students. There were trendy local artists, and there were oil and gas executives. There were farmers, cowboys, engineers. There were residents from the North Fort Collins Trailer Park, ladies from the League of Women Voters, New Belgium executives. And there were recent retirees just in town for the weekend to house shop for an impending move to Fort Collins. And there were cranky third-generation residents exuding a sense of irritation at how crowded the room was. And so on, and so on. It was a big room. So then the dream version of the search committee said to me, "For your second interview, we would like to see you build community with the people assembled here. And we'll watch." And then I woke up, which is really unfortunate. Even still, I understood right away why my subconscious had created such a fun experiment. So many of the questions that we addressed in the first interview came down to how we create community across our differences. It would be a question in any community, as every gathering of humans is filled with vast diversity. But it is an especially relevant and vital question for us as Unitarian Universalists, gathered in this particular congregation at this particular time. It is especially important because sometimes, I know, particularly in the transition, we are unclear how to live out of this idea in real life, how to practice this idea in our congregations and in our wider community, if it's possible, or even if we should. And this question is especially important because there is nothing, absolutely nothing, the world needs more now than to see, learn from, and experience our good news that we need not think alike to love alike. As Krista Tippett writes, we seem to be losing any connective tissue for engaging at all on a human level across ruptures of disagreement. Across the political spectrum, many increasingly turn to journalism, not for novel points of view. What we once called the red state, blue state divide is now more like two parallel universes where understandings of plain fact are no longer remotely aligned. This leads to a diminishing sense of the humanity of those who think and live differently than we do. Even we, who proclaim otherwise, don't know how to resist this kind of thinking. We sing this anthem about standing on the side of love, which I sing too, I enjoy. It's been an important song, but it is not actually our theology. Our theology, our tradition, affirms that in this life there are no sides. Our theology affirms that the line of good and evil does not run between people, but through them. A few years ago, Unitarian Universalist minister Jan Christian came to the First Universalist Church in Denver to speak about her book, Leave No Brother Behind, in which she traces her journey to uncover her brother's service and eventual death in Vietnam. Now, many things have stuck with me from her talk, not the least of which were her observations about the continued relevance of the conflict around Vietnam and the war. What she said then, and what she reiterated to me in a recent conversation, was that Vietnam revealed and then intensified how Americans have never really learned how to disagree and yet stay in relationship. We think if we're against an idea, we're against the person. We call people out instead of inviting them in. We break out into affinity groups, often with neat labels, and assume that our group all agrees and sees things in the same ways we do. We make decisions based on what our group believes. We disregard information that doesn't conform to our position, especially if it is provided by someone other that we identify as the other side. Since marriage equality became the law last year, I've been thinking about the success we've seen in gay rights over the past 50 years, and what we should learn about how social change happens from that. I mean, even 20 years ago when I came out, it was a totally different world. Carrie and I used to be nervous holding hands in Boulder. Boulder! It's true. Who would have ever thought that 20 years later, a photo of us kissing in celebration of our legal marriage would be featured in the Coloradan? When I try to figure out what worked in this culture shift, I don't have any scientific data, but I do have my parents, my good, loving parents, who I came out to, and they were so not okay. They hoped I'd grow out of it. They told Carrie she was nice enough, but they hoped she'd meet a nice man, and that I would too. It wasn't easy, those first 5 years. We had to do a lot of biting our tongues, all of us. And we had some really hard, heartbreaking conversations. But through it all, we stayed connected. We didn't give up on our relationship. We just stopped working so hard to change each other's minds. And from this simultaneous leaning in and letting go, an incredible thing happened. A miracle. Within 5 years after I first came out, my parents changed entirely. They started to tell me how lucky I was to be married to Carrie, JM, how she is the perfect partner. They speak out about gay rights, and though they boycotted our first commitment ceremony, they were thrilled 10 years later to come to our legal civil union in 2013. And even though she told me initially she hoped I never had children, since my children were born, my mother could not be a more proud and loving grandmother or bigger supporter to Carrie and I as moms. It is a miracle and another kind of grace. And the only way this miracle was possible was because we stayed connected through this huge, heartbreaking disagreement. Because none of us drew a hard line. None of us imagined each other as the other side. And I refused to listen to the things my mother said early on and write her off as a homophobe. I knew she was just my mother, struggling, human, trying to love me. From what I can tell, this intimate family scene played out countless times across the globe over the past 50 years. Of course, the miracle didn't always happen, but it happened enough. And then, as poet Seamus Heaney puts it, the longed-for tidal wave of justice rose up, and hope and history rhymed. May it continue. Going back to my dream. So if the search committee had created such a challenge for my second interview, I'm pretty sure that my first strategy would have been to invite the people present to tell their stories. One at a time, in the first person, what they care most about, what they're afraid of, what they hope for. But before that, I would ask everyone else to listen while they heard the other's speech. No arguing, no talking back, no agree, disagree, no interrupting, just listen and receive. And there would be no time for response after the listening. Something happens when we listen to each other like this. That same experience of grace revealed in our vulnerable moments comes to the surface. Whereas the need to be right keeps us from relationship, the act of listening creates relationship. Rather than furthering the separation, listening restores a sense of wholeness. As Margaret Wheatley says, neither I nor the world changes from my well-reasoned, passionately presented arguments. It's worth saying again. Neither I nor the world changes from my well-reasoned, passionately presented arguments. Things change when I've created even the slightest movement towards wholeness, moving closer to another through my patient, willing listening. Now really try to imagine with me the room I described, that dinner party, and then imagine each of them listening to each other. It's hard, I know. If they avoided anything real, they just talked about sports and the weather and dinner itself. I mean, that's not so hard to imagine. But if we're saying they would actually share about what truly mattered in their lives and were allowed to use their own language, their own metaphors, wow. It feels risky, right? I mean, imagine if you were there, sitting near someone who you think of as them. And then imagine listening to that person tell their story, their truth, with an intent to understand them. It feels uncomfortable. Dangerous, even. And we tend to think that if we let certain ideas in, if we make space to understand, then we are agreeing with those ideas. And if we listen with an open heart, we are implicitly offering our approval. We confuse understanding with agreement, and we confuse love with approval. But love doesn't mean approval. Love just means we need each other, even when we disagree. Now imagine we aren't talking about the dinner party. We're talking about us. We, the Foothills Unitarian Church, on the brink of a new ministry partnership. Imagine. It is our task to create an environment and the appropriate forums for it to be safe for any of us to speak honestly about those things which matter most, about our fears, our hopes, our struggles. Imagine it is our core task to make space for all the different metaphors and language and meaning making any of us might engage along life's journey. And imagine that in our big tent, rather than believing that it is possible to hold this much diversity and maintain a perpetual sense of ease, imagine it is our practice to be that safe place where we can be uncomfortable. It is, after all, in that place of safe discomfort where transformation, real change of heart, and change of lives happens, and where these moments of grace reveal themselves. The dinner party of my dream was about building community for just one night. But our hope, our dream, is that we will build and maintain community throughout our whole lives. And our hope is that the goodness of this lifelong, diverse community reaches out far beyond our own community to transform hearts and lives all across Fort Collins, Northern Colorado, and far beyond. This is, after all, what differentiates religious community from a social community. We are always for more than just ourselves. As we look ahead to our new partnership, I imagine a big vision, Big love, big impact, a beautiful, generous, creative, and joy-filled ministry. I imagine this because I know who you are, and I can see what we are capable of together. It is not theoretical. If I hadn't spent the last 3 years with you and the last past 18 years in this area, maybe I couldn't speak so confidently. But because I know you, I have no doubt. Our shared ministry will be big love, big impact, big generosity, big creativity, big joy. And central to this vision is our big tent, where we make space for all who welcome all. If we are to do great and bold things together, this practice must be at our center. Our difficult and increasingly polarized world needs us to learn new habits and new responses to life's big questions. It needs us to let go of proving how we're right and instead step into the risky and beautiful practice of making space to hear another's story. It needs us to ground ourselves in the fullness of the Unitarian Universalist tradition, a tradition that has been saying since the 16th century, we need not think alike to love alike. And the world needs us to refuse to draw lines between people and instead to maintain this crazy idea that across all our differences, something more important connects us. The world needs this from us. We need this from us. May we together make it so. Amen.